Good morning. We're just recognizing that we're a little behind. Good morning. Sorry to interrupt the conversation, but it's exciting to see everybody. I'm just reflecting on when we started our very first meeting and where we are now, and congratulations to all of you. As I look at all of you, you've become so very involved. You've made a significant difference at CORI with your dedication to engagement. I would like to open by welcoming those individuals who are online joining us on the phone lines. So we will make a few introductions, and we'll go around the table so we can share for those who are on the phone who's at the table. And then we'll walk through the agenda. I want to acknowledge Rachel and Anya, who have raised their hands back there, who have helped lead the organization of this. And I'm going to invite them to keep us on time and also interrupt us especially when I'm forgetting to say something. Let's go around the room I'd like to start with some introductions. There's been some significant changes at CORI with the engagement staff that I'm excited to introduce. I'd like to start by introducing Jean Slutsky, who is our new Chief Officer of Engagement. And she has stepped in, as we know, that Ann Beal left to join Sanofi as the Chief Patient Officer in Engagement, an entirely new position. And Jean has joined us from a long background at AHR2, which a lot of us are familiar with. And Jean's been very involved in patient and stakeholder engagement in the AHR2 realm. So we're excited to have Jean. Jean has a background in dissemination and implementation that will really help guide us. We heard an invitation to create a rubric on dissemination this morning, so we might be discussing that as a team. I would also like to, and Jean's going to make a few comments, I think, after we go around the room. I'm also very pleased to introduce, and you guys helped create this. We have recently successfully filled two engagement officer positions, as we envisioned maybe two meetings ago, to assure that when we implemented the rubric, we were not just creating a rubric, but we were going to have the assurance that this rubric was going to be implemented and followed and monitored throughout the lifetime of the project. And we have, as you are seeing, Kim sitting on the side of the room, and we think Kim, you should be at the table. But Kim is our very first engagement officer. She will be working with the engagement team. Yay, Kim. I can just say we're delighted to have her. And you know Kim's spirit, and you know Kim's vision in terms of engagement, and you will be assured to know that Kim will be implementing that kind of spirit within CORI. I'd also like to introduce J.B. Smalley, who is our second engagement officer, and she's going to be over. J.B. comes to us as an urban fellow, and we thought she was so wonderful that we wanted to keep her. And she has committed 150% of her time to understanding and helping move along patient engagement in the CORNET. And she's been working very closely with the PBRNs and the CDRNs and has just shown a tremendous amount of commitment to moving that forward. And so welcome our first two EOs, and here we have some more staff coming in the door. So when we get around you guys, we'll introduce you. We have Gail Hunt, one of our board members here, are very committed in attending our meetings. So with that, we'll go around the room so our listeners know who we are. And so we'll pass it to Jean.
I'm Jean Slutsky, and as Sue said, I'll make a few remarks after we go around the room.
I'm Laurel Pratt. I think I've met most of you. I'm with the MRG Oncology, now I am, as a patient advocate, and the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance and the Society of Nuclear Medicine, and I'm a patient advocate. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Regina Greer-Smith. I'm president of Healthcare Research Associates, a patient advocate. I represent patients, and I'm also the principal investigator of the STAR Initiative.
Hi, I'm Julie Moretz, and I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Patient and Family Centered Care at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. But first and foremost, I am a family leader, and that's how I got started with this work.
I am Lorraine Johnson, and I am I am the Executive Director of BlindDisease.org. I sit as a co-chair on Consumers United for Evidence-Based Medicine, which is a coalition of 40 patient groups nationwide, and I am also on the Executive Committee of PCORnet.
I'm Pastor Bruce Hansen, and I am first and foremost a patient advocate out of a rural setting, and been with PCORI for a couple of years now, done some grant reviewing, and was just appointed to the American Board of Internal Medicine on critical care.
Hi, I'm Kristen Carman. I'm a vice president at the American Institutes for Research and do a great deal of work in this area of patient and family engagement.
Good morning. I'm Charlotte Collins. I'm chair of this advisory committee, and I'm also a senior vice president at the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, and I'll say I'm also a member of the American Thoracic Society.
Good morning. I'm Darius Tandon. I'm co-chair of this committee along with Charlotte, and I'm on the faculty in the School of Medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago.
Hi, I'm Amy Gibson. I work for the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, and I'm here representing patients and families.
Hi, I'm Sarah Vangertruden. I'm the Executive Director of PPSI.
Hi, I'm Perry Cohen, a Parkinson's patient for 18 years and a patient advocate.
I'm Melanie Nix. I'm co-founder of Breast Cancer Concept Site. I'm a breast cancer survivor and a patient advocate.
Good morning. I'm Mark Booten. I am a staff person at the National Health Council and a patient advocate for about 25 years.
Good morning. I'm Paul Arthur. I'm a clinical member of the committee. I'm an occupational therapist at the University of Florida.
Hi, I'm Steve Lim. I'm director of patient-reported outcomes at GlaxoSmithKline, representing industry.
Good morning, I'm Steve Arcano with Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. I represent patients and families.
Good morning, I'm Courtney Clyde, Senior Program Associate with Patient Engagement.
Good morning, I'm Kristen Kanaka. I'm an associate with the Stakeholder Engagement Team.
Great, thank you. I'm just marveling at all of you, and I just appreciate what you've all contributed to this this initiative. You guys helped create ourselves, and I just look at all of you and think of all of the other ways that you have become embedded in other areas of PCORI, like Lorraine with PCORnet, Pastor Bruce and Terry. Are involved in an extra research project that is funded by PCORI. And so I'm seeing Julie has done presentations, Regina has done presentations. I see a lot of you really active out there on behalf of PCORI, so we appreciate that. Jean is now going to share a few comments with you, and then we're going to ask Darius and Charlotte as chair and co-chair before we take off if you have any kind of opening remarks you want to make as well.
I'm just going to take a couple minutes. Some of you know me probably better than you want to know me on the panel, and some of you don't know me at all, so maybe some of you know me a little bit. Those are probably the best folks because you know me a little bit, not enough to know ooh and not enough to say wow. But anyway, I see the people who know me well laughing. So it's really, truly an honor. I've been at PCORI now for a little over 6 weeks, but have been involved in PCORI as an organization for 3 years since its inception. So it's truly an honor to be in a position and an honor to be working with you as both staff members of PCORI and as this committee on patient engagement. What's really unique, and you know, I have to thank Joe for this, is that I not only am the Chief Engagement and Dissemination Officer, but I also direct the Communication and Dissemination Research Portfolio, which will really help drive science activities and engagement activities even closer together, which I think is really important to have these two activities be very interrelated so that they influence each other. And that's, I think, job one for me, along with a lot of other things. But I hope that that unique perspective of being involved in the science of comparative effectiveness research and the engagement of stakeholders in the importance of doing and evaluating, disseminating, and implementing patient-centered outcomes research, those two activities must be very, very interrelated. And I look forward to working with you to carrying out that goal. I'm going to be here, so if there are any questions you have, I'm happy to answer them. But even if you can't think of what you asked me today, you can always ask me after we leave here today. So, I'm really thrilled to be here.
Thank you, and we're thrilled you're here. Tara, Darius, do you have any comments you want to just, any reflections?
I hope you'll allow me a much-used hiking metaphor. I spent most of last week in the beautiful, beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains and spent some time hiking. And I think that in the last year, we've really spent some time on a pretty good climb. It's been a steady climb. We're sort of at a point now that we should be able to take in the vistas, and a big part of that vista is the rubric about patient engagement. I remember last year when we came together the first time, we had a chance to interact with our colleagues on other advisory panels. The big question was, well, what are you guys going to be doing? What's patient engagement? And I think that through, if you know, there are a lot of things that we've been doing that we can begin to see as part of PCORI's VISTA, but I think there's nothing more prominent than the patient engagement rubric. So this is a good time for us to both take into account where we've come from and what's behind us, but it's also a good time for us to take a deep breath because we've got another little climb to go. Thanks very much for everyone's participation and for the energy that you've shown.
I have nothing more elegant than that.
Great, thank you. Darius, I've never seen you speechless before. So I'm going to quickly review what we're going to be talking about, but we're going to look at and we're going to bring you up to date on the various programs that you've helped create, the pipelines, the ambassador program. We're going to talk about the rubric. We're going to talk about dissemination and implementation. And something that, as we think about the programs, they're funded, they're real, they're ongoing, and they're good, but they can be better. And we want you to think about how can we take all of our programs to the next level. Because I think that we want to make sure that we're doing something unique that's powerful and that's going to make an impact. So let's kind of all think about how do we look at each program and even make them better. Now, the next hike that Charlotte might be talking about, but one hike that I know that we're going to have to take, is we're going to be hiking into not only dissemination implementation, but we're going to be taking a big leap into PCORNET. And this is a whole different way of thinking. This is actually tomorrow, but I'm just kind of giving you an overarching. PCORNET is a really exciting opportunity for patient engagement and for research in general. But we really are going to invite this group to understand PCORNET, to advise on PCORNET what we need. We just restructured the way that Cornet has patient engagement kind of infused in it. And so we're structuring it so that the PEEP will be at times a sounding board for issues that are especially sensitive, such as privacy and autonomy. And Lorraine will speak more about this tomorrow, but I really want to know that you're going to help take this to a higher level, because something that we have to really have to ensure is that there's public trust, and especially patient trust, in this network that's being created. And so we're trying to look at the highest level of integrity when it comes to patient engagement and scrutiny, quite frankly. So with that, I just kind of summarized all that, but I'm going to invite Courtney and Kristen to jump right into the pipelines. As you know, we launched the pipelines last summer. They're now going full steam, and I'm going to just turn it over to Courtney.
Good morning. I have for you just one slide on what I'm going to cover here in this presentation. Then Kristen also has two slides to talk about with the pipeline evaluation. So I just want to let you all know that there are going to be some minor changes to the pipeline to proposal initiative, and the primary thing is that we are going to be removing them from the engagement awards so that they'll stand alone as their own initiative. And the reason for that is that there's been some confusion on the side of those who are applying for these awards, as well as creating better clarity or better understanding of what the purpose of the pipelines is. And as I said, so it's going to be its own initiative, but it's still falling under patient engagement. Additionally, we'll be renaming the intermediate funders, and the reason for that is we wanted to give folks a better sense of what it is that the intermediate funders will be doing. They're not just going to be a pass-through. They're going to provide, or they actually are right now with Colorado Foundation for Public Health and the Environment. They're providing technical assistance as well as fiscal agent services, as well as just managing the awards to make sure that the awardees are meeting the deliverables and they have all of the tools that they need in order to do that, including developing a governance structure as well as a communications structure. And also, as they are going to be moving through the pipeline, as you may recall, there are three tiers to this pipeline. So right now the awardees that we have are in the tier one. And we are hoping that within the next few months, they will end their this award by October 15th. We're hoping that they will then be able to advance on to Tier 2. The Tier 2 portion, when that becomes available for application, that'll start in October. And at that time, as I mentioned, we are hoping that all 30 of our current awardees are able to advance in that structure. But they will have to compete, as anyone would, for an award for prompt reporting. We have, as I mentioned, the intermediate funders will, we haven't decided on their name yet, so we are bandying about four names, I believe it is, and that's the Pipeline Awards Proposal Office, or sorry, Program Office. PCORI Field Office, PCORI Extension Office, and there's a fourth one that I'm forgetting, and I apologize about that.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we would probably put Pipeline Awards PCORI, just so that people don't think PCORI actually has field offices in the entire organization, so that Pipeline Awards would be in front of each of those.
Thank you for that clarification, Jane. Right now, we've just closed an RFQ, and the RFQ was for the awardee management, formerly known as the intermediate funder structure, and we received five bids. The five bids were for the southern region and the northeastern region, as well as the national region. We are in the process of still analyzing the cost proposals for those RFQs. And in the next week or so, we hope to announce that. Because we didn't receive a quote for the Midwest region, we've decided to reopen the bid, and we will be doing some targeted outreach to public health institutes in the Midwest, as well as other organizations in the Midwest that have a history of patient engagement and
patient and community engagement program. And the next. Rachel, do you have the handout? Okay. All right. Well, in your folder, Gail, in the folders is a timeline that shows when the next RFP for the Tier 1s are due. And let's see here. For the Northeast and the South region, as well as the Midwest, we are projecting to have that RFP released as of May 15th. So right now we're in the process of refining the initial RFP that we put out last year and updating that for this next call for proposal. So that will be for the Northeast region, the South region, as well as the Midwest region. The Colorado area will again be in Tier 1, Cycle 3, which will take place next year.
And what would be, approximately, how many of these do you expect to award Tier
1? Tier 1 total, it's about 110 over a period of 2 years.
Oh, but I meant
for this next round, sorry. That'll be 40. So it'll be 10 in each region. It'll be 10 in the Northeast, 10 in the South, 10 in the Midwest, and 10 nationally.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Courtney, may I ask a question? Yes. Has there been a change in requirements from the Colorado experience to where we're at now so that the intermediate funders, is there something in the requirements to be a formally intermediate funder that made it possibly, I don't want to use the word difficult, to I guess, rework requirements for intermediate funders? And then, also, it's interesting that the Midwest hasn't applied because we have a PDRN. Can you share that, or is there something that, I don't know if I'll use the word. It's interesting that the Midwest hasn't been, hasn't answered or requested an RFP.
And honestly, we were surprised. We didn't hear from the Midwest either, and that's why we reissued the quote, because we think they're out there. In terms of changing the requirements for the intermediate funder, not really. No, we haven't. That hasn't significantly changed. So this is not new.
Okay. Yep. Are you learning something from the Colorado intermediate funder that some new expectations or some lessons learned that you can share with us?
Certainly. Among the lessons learned, we have learned many lessons. We have been one to say that this is a pilot. So in any situation when you're doing a pilot, there are always lessons to be learned. And among those lessons is sometimes just a bit of greater clarity in terms of what it is that we are looking for in awardees. And that, as I mentioned, is one of the reasons why we are removing the pipeline proposal initiative away from the engagement awards, because there was some confusion. Someone would apply for a pipeline award, and actually we had two folks that applied, and their budget was well over $200,000. And it was like, no, this is the engagement awards you're actually more interested in, not the pipeline. The pipelines would just start people off. And so some of the lessons that we've learned have caused us to, reshape and retweak a few things, as well as just the RFP process. So I think initially our RFP was maybe about 20 pages, and so we realized, we need to pare this down a little bit. And there's certain things that don't necessarily need to be repeated, but certain things that need to be moved up in terms of, the expectations and the deliverables that we're expecting from the awardees.
Something else that I'll start with. And
our last meeting here in January, we were given a time. We were given a timeline that I think the next tier one awards would, or RFPs would be announced in February 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that delayed? I only say that because I was presenting to this huge group of researchers, and they were so interested in this. And so I'm just curious, because now they're wondering, okay, when can we do it? When can we do it? And I promise I'd come back with information. And my second question is, where would Arkansas fall, Southern or Midwest?
Southern. Yeah, the lowest in the, or the most southern state in the Midwest is in Nebraska.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But to answer your question in terms of why we switched from February until now is basically because we wanted to get the new intermediate funders in place. And we did have to extend that RFQ so that we could get the bids in that we needed. We had a couple of snow days that also resulted in some challenges as far as getting things on the website and getting things posted. Getting answers to questions and whatnot. So that all has caused us to delay just a little bit. But please let your folks know that we hope to have that open as of May 15th. What region would you?
We'd be in the southern part of Arkansas.
Yeah, so.
Arkansas, you did say that.
We hope to have that open on May 15th. And there will be a letter of inquiry that will be required first to let us know what it is that folks are interested in doing in their projects. And after that letter of inquiry is then received and reviewed, we will then invite people to proposal.
And I also didn't see that on the website. You know, I see the other awards on there, but I haven't seen any new information unless I just missed it. So.
No, we're revamping that site.
Okay.
Yeah, so within the next couple of weeks, you should definitely see some new information.
And I'd just like to add that as we sat back and look at the opportunity of the pipelines, and especially having this now rolling out into the region, we really wanted to make sure that working with Colorado, that we were incorporating the learnings of working with this and some of their challenges. I shouldn't even say challenges, but much of time, especially like writing the contract with the awardees, and then some hand-holding that we're recognizing at the pre-engagement level. It's time-consuming, especially right up front, as these partnerships are just beginning. So we wanted to make sure we had this well done before we stepped into it, just to stay on the timeline. So that's why we stepped back just a little bit. But in terms of what we're learning also, and Kristen's going to talk about this a little, we really see this as a learning laboratory. So we want to be able to capture really rich information from this pre-engagement phase, because we think that there's going to be some very rich information at this juncture. So we wanted to get ourselves really established before we started to roll this out in a bigger way, because I already know that other funding organizations are waiting to learn from what we learned from this initiative. And so maybe that could be a good segue, Kristen, for you, and then we can go around the table with additional questions.
Sure. So as you mentioned, we see this as a perfect opportunity to learn from this first pilot of investing in capacity building and partnership building. And so we've built a pretty robust evaluation strategy for the pipeline proposals, and I'll focus on first the tier one because that is the tier that we have funded so far. And we want to test our hypothesis or the objective of this overall program, which was to these micro-contracts for building partnerships and capacity for PCOR, but then also the sustainability of these partnerships in actually pursuing and receiving funding for PCOR. So we see this as a very long-term process, and we're right here at the very beginning just in these micro-contracts for building capacity. But then also we want to follow on and track their actual involvement in applications for PCOR, both our funding and otherwise. So we have multiple data collection mechanisms that we are using now, both from the PI or the awardee, but also their partnerships which they develop. And here are just some of the bullets of which we hope to learn. What are some of the elements of successful partnership structures? So their governance structures, the communication structures, their activities. The different components of their partnership, and we want to be able to capture and call these promising practices to learn from, but also to share and distribute so that others can learn as well. did these partnerships embody the PCORI engagement principles, which you all are familiar with, and these are getting to relieve the quality and value of the partnership that which they develop from the perspective of the awardees and their partnerships. So do each of these partners feel respected? Do they feel that their opinion was valued by their partners, and to get to kind of that meat and potatoes of the partnership which they developed? And then we want to track these partnerships as they apply to other Tier 2 or Tier 3 funding opportunities, to PCORI's research funding opportunities, to other funding opportunities. We want to see then track the sustainability of the partnerships and what results from those. So we are just eager to learn as much about these partnerships as possible and continue to look forward to kind of see where they go so we can learn from that and share their best practices.
Great, thank you. We have time to go around the room if there's additional questions or comments or thoughts, how we can, any ideas on how we can evaluate this in a better or stronger way, how we can communicate this to our respective communities, Gail?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Oh, I see. Gail proposed that we use existing research tools or existing evaluation tools from community-based research. And actually, we've absolutely borrowed a lot from CDPR. DeVerka's tool is actually the basis for which we developed our data collection tool to measure these types of value elements in the partnership. So, absolutely. And we do plan on integrating this with the PCORI evaluation group, and we've been working closely with the staff on that team as well.
Yes, I would like for there to be consideration when there is a possible change in the rollout or implementation. Is there a period that the public can have? You know, if you can let the public know that there's going to be a change, because you know, I'll agree with Julia. Many communities were ready to apply, but there's a little bit waiting for it to come to the Midwest. And so there's a delay, and I don't think everybody really got that, you know, information. So there could be, I guess, more robust outreach to let that there's going to be a delay. And also consideration possibly, if there's going to be, a change in scope, is there a possibility for, I'll just call it public comment period from patients, so they can consider what the changes might be from what they were previously stated, possibly an RFP? Because I think we would like to chime in to see how that might impact us, because there are many communities who have already been involved in these types of programs, other funders, who may have an experience level that they could already be considered for something, or if the application process or requirements may be, I guess, revised. Say, for instance, you might have a community group who have already been funded before, and who may be good candidates for a pipeline system proposal, but maybe have, say, for instance, if you've already been a recipient or an awardee of this type of grant, it may put you on a higher, I guess, consideration level, but to incorporate something like that into that.
Well, in terms of, yes, your request to be more informed about changes is absolutely, we do need to do a better job of that. And so I think that when there are changes, especially that you are all out there speaking with the public on our behalf, you know, talking about the pipelines and generating enthusiasm. And so I totally agree that we can do a better job at communicating when there are changes. In terms of scope, like in Tier 1, and we really haven't changed, that hasn't changed. And so that has really stayed quite firm in terms of what is Tier 1, what is Tier 2. And actually, Kristen has been working on kind of a tool that applicants can go through, kind of a triage tool, almost like a decision tree. If this, then go to this step. If this, then you're not eligible. So we're really trying to help people understand the different tiers and where they fit in. And that actually, I think, is going to go online in the very near future to help once we have all of our IAFs in place. This is going to take off, and so we need to make sure that we help those applicants understand where they fit and if they fit. Because some of them, we get applications that actually go to the bigger funding. So in terms of your comment about public comment, I'm not too sure how to answer that, but we do need to get feedback somehow. So that's a great, and we do, like in when we do have feedback from those who have applied and have to review, but if there's other areas where you see that we're not capturing, then let's talk about that and see how we can make sure we get the comments in.
I have one more observation. You know, looking at the pipeline to proposals, very exciting. You know, you get the pipeline of proposals, and then you get our great engagement rubric, and you go, gosh, this is a great journey for communities to be more involved and engaged in research as never before. And these resources would be very important and instrumental to get communities engaged and get them PCOR ready as we have in our requirements. You know, and I'm hoping that possibly the new timeline will not impact or negatively impact patients being ready for the next cycle, if you see what I mean, you know. Because I'm going to work very hard to really, you know, do whatever I'm doing and more to follow to get communities ready to participate in us. Because it's happening now. I'm seeing more researchers really reaching out to the community and bringing everybody coming to the table. And, you know, it was great that these resources would be available. We're still going to do it, but a consideration. Yeah.
And I did just want to add, for those of you who did review the application that we received in the first cycle, there is a survey that's been sent out, and so it closes, I think, May 2nd, I think is the date. So I can resend that for those of you who it may be buried in your email, but we definitely want your feedback on that review process. The next cycle of review is even smoother than this past cycle. So far, I've heard from a few folks, and I've heard that it was very good, and, you know, they felt that they had the necessary tools to do that review, but there's still room for improvement, for sure. And then one other piece is that as far as pairing the engagement rubric and with the pipeline proposal awards, we've seen that there's some room possibly within Tier 3 to help those folks who may have not been successful in the past in applying for a PCORI award. There's some tools that they can take or some information that they can take or glean from the engagement rubric to build up their application.
Yeah, one more comment. How are the awardees doing with the ones that awarded in December? How's that going? Is there a negotiation or have they started their projects?
Several, the majority of the projects are, you know, in motion. We've actually had some exciting developments in terms of the Cystic Life project, which is focuses on cystic fibrosis and developing an e-community around that in the Western region. We found that they're actually moving a little faster than we expected them to because the cystic fibrosis community, usually they can't necessarily meet together. But, you know, they're doing a lot of outreach, and they're really developing their governance structure, and they've got a monthly newsletter going. We've got the folks up in
in Washington State working on sudden infant death syndrome and SIDS, and they're doing very well getting community buy-in and community support on this issue. The purpose of their project is to look at using an evidence-based project that started in Seattle and applying it to their community. I think it's in Snohomish, Washington.
We also have a pipeline recipient from Wyoming, who's going to have Parkinson's disease and is going to participate with us on a webinar on Wednesday on the matchmaking app. So we're really trying to integrate the pipeline recipients into our community. And really, I think at our next advisory panel meeting, that's when we're really going to have some great stories to share with you about where is this going. And going back to the rubric, I mean, we see an opportunity to almost build a pre-rubric rubric, because we're going to see promising practices surface on these partnership development and engagement by the community. So we might even be developing another kind of rubric once we see what is really happening out there and for when we want to see partnerships developed and communities engaged. So we're really excited to see what we're going to learn and how do we embed that in something that can help others go through this process maybe a little easier. Any other comments on the pipeline?
I just want to make a comment on the review process because I went through it the first time, and one of the comments that I had was that we didn't really calibrate, so different people reviewing a proposal might come up with different scores, and we never really had that opportunity to get together at the end and say, okay, so how did we assess this and make sure that we were sort of on the same page? And so I'm wondering if you have any plans to incorporate that.
We've considered some options for that, including like teleconferences, basically because everyone is so spread out, no one's really being brought together, and you're doing it from where you're located. That's the best option to be able to bring people together to discuss those scores after they've been scored initially is probably to do a teleconference.
And there's one other thing I might suggest is as we're going through and we're granting these, it might be nice to do, you know, a spotlight on different awardees just because some people who might be thinking about applying for a, you know, for a pipeline award may have no idea what it looks like to apply for that or what it looks like to be successful at that.
Thank you for that idea. Well, as I mentioned, that we are doing a revamp of the pipeline portion of the website, so that's something that we can definitely consider adding in.
They would be great ambassadors.
Right.
The awardees for the pipeline, they would be great ambassadors.
Yeah, they're all invited to come. Yeah. Darius?
Can you walk us through, I'm looking at the Tier 2 and Tier 3 timelines, and I'm not sure that I completely understand. Does RFP release in June, LOI July, RFP close August, award September? So if I'm looking at that correctly, it means within 4 months you're announcing it, you're getting applications, you're reviewing it, and you're awarding. Is that correct? So my concern about that is if you're really holding true to principles of partnership and bringing different groups together, if you're releasing something in June, you're basically saying, researchers and other folks need to get together like that and put together a proposal. And my concern is that that's not enough time for a real meaningful partnership to come together and submit an application, and you might get things that are less than ideal.
I have a comment. For Tier 1, a partnership is not required. And so that's probably the difference in terms of Tier 1. It can be, we want to hear their plan to develop a partnership, but they do not have to have a partnership already formed. For Tier 2, we think there's a lot of partnerships already out there. That, I mean, a lot of them are applied for Tier 1, and they really were applicants for Tier 2. Does that address your question?
It does, but so an example of a Tier 2 question would be, let's figure out as a partnership what are some PCOR-related questions that we want to focus on for our partnership. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even if that's the focus of a Tier 2 award, I think it's, be careful how I say this, I don't think it's optimal to give folks only a month or two to put together an application because, again, if you're really holding true to these principles, it takes time to come together, deliberate, talk about what a
Tier 2 or Tier 3 proposals should look like. So I guess, you know, I'm sitting here as a researcher in the room saying, yeah, I could put it together in a month, but I would probably do it with minimal input from different stakeholders if that's as much time as you're giving me. So I'm just throwing that out there as something that I'm concerned about.
Thank you.
I think that's good input. I mean, I think it's something that we need to discuss amongst ourselves, and are we allowing enough time for a meaningful proposal to come into the door? So,
let me just say, at the same time I'm saying this, I think that this is one of the most exciting parts of all things PCORI. I think that more money should be going into these Tier 2 and Tier 3 awards. I think that this is a great way, and, you know, going on what Kristen's saying in terms of the evaluation, in terms of getting folks to submit for larger PCORI applications or funding elsewhere. So I think that this is really great, and I don't want to slow it down, but I want to give that caution.
I think that's reasonable. I mean, we also think this is
We think this is a great opportunity for us to create impact. Leanna, welcome. I just welcome Leanna, yeah. So thank you. We need to take all this into consideration. We don't want to slow it down unnecessarily, but we, like I said, we want to continuously improve on this and be smart about how we roll this out. So we'll discuss this amongst the board and see how we can best go forward.
I would agree with Daria. You know, I will say from personal experience, we're talking about a 6-month journey to really get relationships going in the community of researchers to get to the point of really, you know, deciding on we want to partner and having resources together to really further that engagement or partnership. So more time is needed to really have those conversations, because many times the conversations are not local, they're long distance, because we're doing a lot of online engagement now with communities and researchers. So,
first of all, I'm sorry to join you all late, but I'm very happy to be here with you now. One comment I just want to make about the deadlines is that, you know, there is a tendency to expand to fill the time, and especially if there are existing partnerships already. I also would caution to not make the deadline be so long, right? Not to extend it to 6 months or a year, because things will expand to fill that space. And one of the exciting parts about this pipeline is the fact that we're encouraging partnerships to form and to give space for existing partnerships that exist already.
Yes, I was wondering. I've heard other people at different conferences speaking of PCORI, and they're not really related with PCORI, and yet I wondered if there's some way that we can bring all of these people to kind of a simple understanding as far as PCORI goes, or do we have different people talking about PCORI where we're PCORI and they're in different areas? And I was just curious if anyone else has had that experience.
An observation that, you know, PCORI isn't the only funding agency that funds patient-centered outcomes research. And, you know, one of the goals of PCORI is to influence other funders, and that there will never be total homogeneity of, you know, how people are speaking about patient-centered outcomes research. But what PCORI can help to do is to influence those other funders so that there are common threads amongst the goals of those funding agencies. So you're likely, depending on what venue you're in and who the researcher is receiving funding from, or the patient or consumer group they're aligned with different organizations, will have, you know, slightly different messages that they're going to speak with. That's not necessarily bad, but it does speak to the fact that it's become a much more prevalent concept to have, you know, patient-centered outcomes research be a mechanism rather than vogue or you know, a new wave type of research. So think what we're seeing is a good thing, and how it plays out in terms of more common goals and themes across those funding agencies will be very positive, hopefully.
No, I agree with what Jean just said. I'm seeing that with internally where I work and in other pharma and other places where we go for conferences, and sort of like everybody's trying to get on the same page. One of the things that really helps is the PCORI methodology reports. And talk about that. People kind of accept that, and there's a common, some common terminology there, common methods, and that helps a lot too.
Yeah.
Well, great. We're actually, but I think we can go into Kristen Carmen's presentation, in that we're going to talk about the roadmap for patient engagement, which, you know, patient engagement has become a phenomena, I would say, not only here in the United States, but globally. But when people talk about patient engagement, oftentimes I say patient engagement in what? Because patient engagement now is fused in all levels of, in terms of direct care, in research, in policy making, in systems improvement, in education, in dissemination. So Kristen, I'll just hand the mic over to Kristen. And Kristen, you can kind of give the background and go forward from there.
Thank you for the introduction and the opportunity to share this call with you. I'm going to do this at 30,000 feet. If there's anything else in particular you want to know about or about what we did, I will let you know. This is more a discussion of what we did and what we're in the process of creating as opposed to the outcomes of this. So this hopefully whets your appetite and interests you in what we'll have to say in a little bit. So in essence, the background to this is the goal of our work, and this is for the George and Betty Moore Foundation, was to bring together a multidisciplinary group of participants, a relatively small group of individuals, to try to develop a roadmap for patient and family engagement. The reasons for this, as you all know, there's a cacophony of definitions, perspectives, approaches, and everyone sees it with a very different lens. So the goal of this was to basically to provide an overarching strategy and a vision for the field. What does it mean? Where can it really go, and what can it accomplish? The foundation for this was the patient and family engagement framework that I created with a number of colleagues and patient advocates on what patient and family engagement is, which is a pretty broad definition. We've heard from others it needs to be expanded, as you know, to research and other things, which is implicit, but we're working on it being more explicit. I'll say that for my PCORI colleagues here now. But the basic point of the framework that everyone was interested in is that engagement is really on a continuum to shared partnership. It's not just consulting people. It's not just asking them after you've decided. It's about including them in the decision-making. It involves more than just engagement in your direct care, but in the organization and the design and the delivery and the policy and the research. And it's not just what patients do. Engagement is about what the system does to support engagement. And think of it that way in this most fundamental sense with a broad perspective and the framework that led into the foundation. So it began last summer. The convening was held at the end of February. And as I mentioned, the funding was from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. So why did we hold this convening? Well, Sue intimated a bit, but we held a convening in essence because we wanted to really create and generate ideas. We needed a high level of energy, and we needed individuals interacting with each other. It wasn't a bunch of people coming in to decide on a bunch of recommendations. It was a bunch of people, multi-stakeholders, everyone from researchers, policymakers, practitioners, many other funders, including PCORI. People on the ground, about 20% were patients themselves or patient advocates, a strong representation to come together and work together. You know, in many respects, there's a lot of ideas about engagement, but not necessarily knowledge, and we wanted people to create a lot of knowledge as well. So we asked people to generate concrete ideas, strategies, tactics, and many other kinds of things. We also wanted to reorient thinking, to be honest, and we used an appreciative inquiry approach, which is not often used in healthcare. We're very familiar with plan, do, study, act, right? What's the problem? What's the solution? We wanted people to move beyond barriers in this field and to be really imaginative and open in their inquiry, and it was a fascinating exercise. I hadn't done it before.
We also, I just want to describe what made it unique and what was so interesting. As I mentioned to you, we all have our own ideas about patient and family engagement, and oftentimes what we would find in meetings is you spend about a day sense-making. Well, this is what I think it is. This is what you think it is, and you, right? So how are we ever going to get to concrete strategies in action? Because this convening wasn't about why should we do engagement, it's how. How do we do it? How do we make it happen? How do we make it happen today? What do we do tomorrow? And what do we have to wait till later? How are we going to make it happen right away? So we did a lot of pre-work. We held what we called micro-convenings, where we brought people together. We had a patient co-edit a paper and solicit input from other patients in the field about what's PFE to you, which was also a real underpinning to the convening. And then we shared that paper with the convenings ahead of time to have discussion and how do we build out your vision of it. We also had white papers and a participant website. So we tried to do a lot of work of that sense-making discussion and some of that visioning prior to getting everybody together so that we could spend that time then building on that and moving forward. Again, as I mentioned, it was a diverse set of stakeholder groups, very interdisciplinary and appreciative inquiry. And fundamentally, the way I explain appreciative inquiry, it's all about starting with the possibilities and continuing. You talk about barriers, but you don't get stuck on them. And I'll describe that in a second. So what we asked participants to do was to develop a vision for the field, literally. And I can tell you now, some people were the first morning going, oh, my God, what are you asking us to do? Because we created visualizations, and we created things for them to work with and manipulatives to help build this roadmap and to change the roadmap. Not easy for a bunch of folks who are used to going to different kinds of meetings. So their job was to generate strategies and tactics at the direct care level for organizational participation, for policymaking. What do people need to do, and how are we going to get there? And they had to talk about factors that would affect it, but they couldn't get stuck on the barriers. They had to talk about the facilitators. And if they found a barrier, they had to figure out how to overcome the barrier. It couldn't just be a barrier. Payment. The payment system couldn't be the barrier to engagement ever happening. What are you going to do if it doesn't change? What else is there to be done? And so folks had to continuously try to do that. And so they had to put these all together into these roadmaps. So this is just a picture of a couple of our participants. So what did we learn about the process? Well, what we found is that people came with very different perspectives, but they found ways to move forward. And this is everyone from researchers, hardcore organizations, financing researchers, to patients found common ground on how to move forward. It was really moving in that way, to be honest. And even the most experienced participants got new ideas. People asked me, what would success be? And I say my blue tip to everyone was that if the 50 people in that room walked out with new ideas and new approaches that they hadn't thought about before, that was my blue chip success. Everything we did beyond that was terrific. And virtually everyone said they learned new ideas, new ways of thinking about doing things that had not occurred to them before that seemed much more reasonable and possible. And that was, I think, a terrific outcome. They also brought a lot of energy and passion, and they felt very personally invested in the end. So almost everyone made a commitment at the end of the convening to what they were personally or organizationally going to put patient and family engagement, move it forward. One of our healthcare executives said he would include as a goal related to PFE in his top annual performance goals for himself as a healthcare executive, and he was going to encourage that occur with every healthcare executive as a part of their association and their state. And there was a lot of really powerful statements like that where people were going to make it much more actionable. Just something quickly on themes, because this is going to be extremely high level and a bit obtuse at this point. We're working a lot more on this. But remember I told you we wanted to start people with the positives, not with the negatives. So how we started today was because there's a lot of worry about PFE not being able to happen because of all the barriers. But we asked people to start with what presents opportunities for you in patient and family engagement? What exists in the system right now that make it more possible to happen? And so people talked about consumer demand and awareness, professionals' capacity for change, the new prioritization of transparency, the growing evidence base. So they really started from a position of what can we build on? What can we use as a lever point to start today? And a tremendous amount of energy around that they needed to get moving on this now. Not going to surprise you. So this is the room at one point. So the first day, there was a lot of breakout sessions of independent work, but by the second day, at this point, folks were sharing their roadmaps after they had made a series of changes. So we used a variety of mechanisms, and we also, the one thing I will note to you from process, if you'd be interested, we did have these facilitated groups to try to help people move along. It was difficult sometimes to think about strategies and tactics. It can feel sort of obtuse or a little bit abstract. So we were able to use quite a few individuals to help people think more concretely sometimes and just help to facilitate the conversation. But anyhow, at this point, they are sharing with each other after a day and a half how they had changed their maps. And they did change pretty radically. And one insight I would tell you was quite fascinating is a lot of people moved a lot of those barriers to just sort of taking for granted things. That is to say, when they started their maps, they were major barriers in their way to getting where they want to be. And then at the end, for a lot of people, they just moved into thoughts, those just exist, but here's how we're overcoming them. It was a real active visualization of some of what they were able to do. But obviously, they thought the sort of dominant model and paradigm of how we think about from a biomedical to a patient-centered sick care to health, revisiting the power dynamics needed to change. And there's a lot of discussion about whether engagement is a means to an end of itself, and what people were able to agree on the end is it was both things and that there was a way to move forward, whether or not you thought this was just what needed to be done or it was a means to an end. You're trying to achieve the triple aim. Engagement's the pathway to getting there. So other people saying, I don't care about the triple aim. Patients need a seat at the table. And folks found common ground and were able to find strategies and tactics and agree irrespective of whether that perspective was. And that was actually really important because people can spend a lot of time getting stuck there. Finally, we coming out of here, we focused on a number of opportunities. These, again, are at such a high level you can't really appreciate because I can't really share them at this point, and we're still working on them. We basically came up with 8 areas of focused action, and each of those 8 areas, and those sort of roll them up even higher, there are a series of strategies and tactics. And as you all know in this business, one person's tactic is another person's strategy, depending on the level of nesting. So part of what we're doing in the analysis is sort of helping to combine these things. The other thing that really came out is a lot of things that surprised people where everyone agreed could just be done now, and that was everyone from healthcare executives, major healthcare systems, and we hope one of the powers of this is people coming out and saying, there's no reason you can't do this. There's no barrier in your way to doing this now. Came up with a lot of, so everything is nested in terms of strategies and tactics in these 8 areas, or now 9, I guess. And then we're talking about things you can do now, things you can do tomorrow, and things that might be longer term. But there's not a barrier that says you can't do them, but for some people it's going to be longer term and they might need more changes. So that's what we're working on in terms of the roadmap. The goal then, the next step, is finalizing the work on this, developing a visualization for this in a roadmap, and working with our steering committee to give us feedback on this before we make this public. And it's also, we're developing a community of action, a community of people who want to work and talk together and expand this outward. We hope, I don't know when this will be released. It could be July. It could be closer to September. The foundation and our partners will really decide that. It depends on a host of things, as you all can imagine. But it will be coming, and it will be coming soon. If anybody has any questions, happy to answer them. Otherwise, look forward to being able to share it with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. I think what was amazing, I had the privilege to participate in Kristen's event, and I think what I walked away with was just really just to recognize how interrelated patient engagement is. There's a lot of people there who are in patient engagement in direct care and being the patient. And so we really moved the thinking to see how there's like a continuum from patient engagement in direct care to patient engagement in systems improvement to patient engagement in research to patient engagement in policy making. It's almost a cycle. So we saw how interconnected all this patient engagement is. So if we can like fill all those lanes in the pathway with patient engagement, that might be the driving force in transforming our healthcare system. So that was kind of the, because we had people there with their own separate belief about patient engagement. When you mushed it all together, that was transformation. So that was really what I walked away with, and just think how exciting it was to invite somebody into the world of patient engagement and research, where it's like,
that was a completely new concept for a lot of people, for most people, quite honestly. I mean, the patient engagement in care is not new. And so they got that. But when we started to really kind of push towards, let's think outside that area into research and policy making, then they kind of started to say, I get why we all need each other and how we are interconnected. So, you know, it kind of sees where we fit in the bigger context of patient engagement into this world that's kind of exploding out there, how we've got now these nice components that, Kristen, you've been a big creator of, really identifying this framework for us. So we can go around the room now. Kristen, you can moderate this part, and should I just go around in the around the horn? So Regina, I'll just go around this way. I don't know who did what, but I'll just go in order, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
First, I want to thank you for convening that. That's really important. My, I have a question as far as you had a hospital executive there, and you had how did they receive the new conversation with patients and really being on the forefront, being in a room with them in this type of meeting? To hear and have like a, I would say, conversation that probably did not occur before.
I will tell you a couple of things, honestly, because I think there's enough of them to do this, so let me be careful. I think there were challenges for everybody there. I think it is fair to say there were challenges because it was appreciative. There was a challenges because we put up those three lanes and we said, you're going to come up with your milestones. What are your endpoints? We said, what are your strategies and tactics? We put cars up there. We put up barrier signs and facilitator signs. And some people were going, what am I doing here? Right? But you know what that did? It leveled the playing field. Right? No one knew how to perform there. No one was the expert in that room. Everybody had to work together to figure out how to succeed. And that was our intention, to level the playing field. And to be honest, we also use facilitators to ensure that the playing field stayed level, but we didn't really have to worry about it because everyone struggled because, as Sue was saying, some folks maybe were very familiar with direct care, but we're not so familiar with the other levels either. So, and I got some notes when I there were some very people struggling during the first day. I got some really nice notes, particularly from folks in the hospital systems, about how positive they were about the experience and how it was a hard 2 days for them. By the second day, they go, wow, I was really glad I did it. It was valuable. And it was extraordinary rewarding for us. We put ourselves and everybody out there way out on a high wire. It was incredible. But they all went out there, and they did it. It was really powerful because of that.
I also want to add, I think we would all agree we need to probably have more of these, I'll call them community conversations.
Yeah.
Where we can get people to the table. You know, Darius and Anger was at our engagement day on March 1st, and we had presentations which were great. What was really, really great, and I hope you, Darius, you'll agree with me, we had our researchers come to the community and sit among us, and we actually ate together, and at the end, we were going to, like, for 2 hours, we were going to have a presentation, but we ended up having an open mic, which really, really honed those relationships building and really getting away some of the myths of research. And really to have our research partners in a big church with our community people really, really, you know, we really became, I think, really more committed to going this journey together.
Yeah.
And getting to know us, so thank you for that.
Lorraine? Yeah, I think it's great you got multi-stakeholders together in a room. I think that is really what's fundamentally going to be necessary to press the conversation forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm now involved with TCORNet, and it's a very different audience than this audience, and so I'm aware much more of the different perspectives that people bring in terms of understanding the value, necessity, or any willingness for patient engagement. But so I appreciate that. I wanted to follow up with you a little bit more on the concept of, what did you call it, appreciative
inquiry?
Because it does seem like the, you know, getting stuck at the barriers is, I think, the biggest impediment to progress. And so I'm curious how you went about that.
Well, I think two things really. One, we were also very influenced by our deliberative work, which is that
that it's very important in when you're having a conversation between people to level the playing field for information between lay audiences and others, but also that you create an environment in which it's okay for reason giving. That is, why do you think something? What's behind what you're thinking? Not because you're trying to create confrontation, but it creates understanding. When you ask someone to explain why you think something or what the assumptions are under it, then you also level the knowledge playing field, right? Everyone can then talk about, oh, I see why you see that way, but here, what if you changed the assumption and went this way? So it really opens it up. There are a variety of practitioners of appreciative inquiry. Actually one of our steering committee members, Marcus Tigeson from Blue Shield, had strongly recommended it. We had not, ourselves included, but our facilitator had, Elopathic Sen, who actually helped to create deliberative panel for NICE in England. And so she brought her experience with it. But we basically looked at a number of practitioners and we sort of developed a lighter version of it for our purposes. If you want afterwards, I'd be happy to discuss, and I'd be happy to share with anyone when we're done what we used as a format for it. But I had not used that direct approach before, so it's not as though you can't pick it up and use it either, to be honest. But I'd happily share some resources with you. But again, I was surprised because it's not used that often in healthcare, and I understand why, because we're always solving problems. But I am a convert to its use in breaking through that to thinking of new ways of seeing problems before we try to solve them. Charlotte?
I wanted to thank you for this presentation. It enriches our program for the 2 days that we're here. And I'm really interested in how you're going to report this rather than the when. It's going to be in July. But will it be through a journal publication or how are you going to get this information out?
Well, it's interesting. We are just going through this process with the funder. I will tell you this. The actual mode or technology of it we're deciding about. Because we realize when you do something this interactive, the key challenge, and this will come with the dissemination issue for all of us, is what's the unit at which you want to communicate something to your audience? What's the unit at which you want them to take it? So if you're creating something and you want your audience to pick it up and use it, right? You have to think about that, the sort of most micro-level unit you want them to pull it at. So for us, it's, is it the tactic, is it the strategy, or is it at the level of those eight areas? How do we think someone's going to use this information? So because we're still working through that, the format is going to be interactive. It's either going to be a highly interactive PDF with access to a web as a sandbox, or it's going to be web-based. We haven't quite figured out. We're still working on what we think is going to be the most accessible to the audience, but gets this out sooner. We have some models for doing this, but it has to be something that allows audiences not to just take the whole thing, but it allows them to pull out chunks and portions of it, because we think people are going to want to share that at that level with other individuals. Also, our attendees have committed to sharing their commitments, and they have committed to sharing their progress on those commitments publicly. And so we are creating a space that will allow for that. And what we are working a little bit on is how much do we allow comment on any of that. It complicates speed and rapidity of getting this out. So we're working on that a little bit, but we hope it is going to be as interactive and it's going to be accessible in a way that our end users, our first point, which is the attendees, and then other people out in the field can use and access it. Mark.
So actually, most of my questions have been answered. So first of all, just really, I think that's really, really impressive and really cool. At the National Health Council, we really focus in on patient engagement at the delivery of care, research, and the development of new treatments. And there's a lot of momentum behind this, a lot of interesting work in the multi-stakeholder approach, but it seems like you've mapped out a method for breaking through with groups that have not thought through these issues. How quickly do you think this will catch fire beyond the delivery of care? So in particular, I'm looking at how you develop new treatments. I think Steve mentioned that this is actually Steve and Stephen, I think, have spoken about this in the past, about how industry is starting to look at this. How can we catalyze this in other areas and make it move more quick?
And do you mean the process itself or the findings? I think you're asking about the process and the method, correct?
That's correct.
Well, one of the things that we're doing, and the foundation's been just terrific. So, Dominic Frosch is my project officer, but what's great about the George and Betty Moore Foundation is, one, they made a strong, they really wanted other funders there. They're looking for collaborative partnerships. So I just want to note that. And they really like creativity, innovation, and they support it. So one of the things they've just agreed to give us resources for is to write up more in depth the method that we use so that we can make that available as well as the approach. So what our goal is to create, I don't know if it'll be quite a tool, but we hope to put in enough information and in enough detail about the process, including the guide that we use, that it will give people an idea of how to implement this themselves if they want to. That would be the goal. Thank you all. I appreciate your questions. It was exciting. Look forward to being able to share it.
I just want to apologize for the noise next door. Yeah, they need to be aware that we can hear them really well.
But they sound really happy.
Kristen, thank you very much. And I'm excited about how patient engagement is kind of coming in now from all directions. And I think the more that we can all work together on patient engagement from these different perspectives, I think we can maybe push this dialogue along a little faster. There are a lot of champions in that room, and there are champions and there are converts. There are people there for the first time that they're having their aha moment. And it was amazing to witness because some of the information was not new. But for some of them, it was new, so we have to be very mindful of that. So, again, thank you, Kristen, and please keep us updated as things get published and as we learn more together to see how we can work together. At this point, were there any other questions for Kristen? At this point, we're going to talk about conflict of interest forms, and do we have, is Emma or, okay. Yeah, sure.
Even though we're running ahead of schedule at a pretty good clip, I have a question that you know maybe should be asked when Joe is available, but maybe at some point in the next 2 days we could get some more insight into this GAO study and you know what that means and how we might be involved in that.
So it was written into the legislation. So GAO has what's called an evaluation of PCORI that is due, I believe, in 2015. They also will do one of AHRQ's use of the PCORI Trust Fund. So just in case, this is sort of like a PCORI Trust Fund 101. Under the ACA, a trust fund was created called the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Trust Fund. So it comes down as a pipe and then bifurcates into three areas. One funds PCORI, another gives a certain amount to the Office of the Secretary for investments and data infrastructure, among other things, and then another goes to AHRQ for use and dissemination, implementation of PCOR findings, and training of the PCOR workforce. And in the same legislation that created the PCORI Trust Fund and PCORI, there are, you know, certain oversight activities, one of which is the GAO engagement. So both AHRQ and PCORI have had their own initial engagement meeting with the General Accounting Office where they've given us some broad questions and over the course of about 6 months, they'll continue to ask additional questions as they learn more about how PCORI has chosen topics, funded its research, gone about its business, established its merit review, essentially established itself as a funding organization, and meeting the intent of the legislation that created it.
actually put together a timeline that shows how GAO does its first review, its second review, when reauthorization happens, which I can share with the group just so you get a visual of how things play out, which I think will be helpful to think about what is going on. I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to shape the environment. Another thing I'd throw out there that I think is interesting, Jim, and curious your reaction to this, that PCORI is sort of has a dual personality as a funding organization and as a mission-related nonprofit. And I think we have to think of it in those terms when it comes to evaluation, which I think is really critical.
Yeah, so actually, the first meeting we had with GAO, and these were actually the same part of, some of them were the same folks that also did the ARA evaluation of the CER dollar evaluation. So they are familiar with comparative effectiveness research. They asked a lot of questions about how the national priorities were established, implementation of patient-centered outcomes research as a vision. So I very much agree that there's sort of a concept-driven idea as well as taking that conceptual vision and implementing it as a funding agency, which that's really been the level of the discussion. But we've only had one meeting. Having been through these engagements before, there are lots and lots of meetings where we'll be able to discuss with the investigators how we go about our business and develop the vision for which, the vision and mission of the organization, which drills down to how we do and do the funding and decide what is appropriate to fund.
Yes. Quick follow-up question, because I realize we're now ready to move on. Should we expect that we might be contacted by one or more of the investigators at GAO?
It's really hard to say. In the past, if they want to know additional information, so let's say they want to know how PCORI has engaged its advisory panels, which are laid out in the legislation, they may, in fact, ask to speak to some of the advisory panel members. I suspect, as they've done in the past, they may go outside of PCORI to speak to other visionaries in the field to see, how the legislation was put together. So not only are they going to try to understand PCORI's vision and how we've implemented the legislation, but they may try to get a better idea of how the legislation was written, just to understand how that vision started with legislation and starts with the organization implementing the legislation in terms of a conceptual vision and then actually putting that into practice. So it's very early. Our engagement meeting was, I think, 10 days ago, if I'm correct, not even 10 days ago. So it's really at the first beginning phase, and we'll be able to give you much more information at the next meeting or next conference call. I anticipate we'll be meeting with them again in the latter part of May and then over the summer as they get to know us, and because a priori they may not know much about patient-centered outcomes research or PCORI, but we'll learn about it through going through our website, understanding what we funded, talking to staff, and looking at our national priorities and advisory panels.
Thank you. I see that Emma is here, and so I'd like to introduce Emma. Emma, I'll let you pronounce your last name. And Emma has been leading, you may have seen Emma's name on some emails that you got. Emma is leading basically all of the advisory panels and doing a lot of the work to set these up and helping us establish processes. And so you'll see Emma's name on some emails. But Emma's going to talk to us about conflict of interest. Joe touched on it this morning. So do you want to join us up here at the mic? And
so you should have been, you should have gotten your COI form at the general session. They were on the chairs, but if you don't have one right now, I have extra ones. Me and Jane Jordan, who is the assistant to the general counsel, are here to answer any individual questions you may have about disclosing COIs, and if not, I can just collect the phone.
Jane, do you want to come up here and speak to us? So, Emma, you're wanting them, is this a document that you're asking them to sign and turn in right now?
Well, if you have it completed right now, yes. If not, you can hand it to anybody from PCORI staff later, or you can grab me, or whatever, but, yeah.
Okay. Is there, go ahead. Just now, Lorraine's card is up.
Yeah, I have a question. If you have filled out a COI for another organization like PCORNET, does that become universal, or you do it for each group?
Well, at this moment, we are doing it for each group because it's just an easier way to organize it. Unfortunately, we're still in the dark ages on paper. When we go online, we might have a little bit different procedure, but if you could do it on paper today, that would be great.
Great. Gary?
I just want clarity on number two, payment received from any healthcare-related services, i.e. consulting, teaching, writing. And then it says disclose others that pay you for any outside research. So if I'm funded by folks to do my own research, is that a disclosure I need to indicate? So NIH, CDC?
Yes. That would be a good idea. Anything that has a perception of potentially biasing someone is something that should be disclosed.
Yeah, so just it's normal to disclose where you receive your funding. So if you receive funding from any source, you should disclose that.
And as Jenna said, just because you what we call conflict of interest, a lot of people actually call it industry disclosure or industry relationship because, you know, conflict has sort of a negative connotation to it, but it's really not.
No, that makes sense to me. I just want clarity on the way it was working.
Is there a specific time period we need to keep in mind? So if we had past activities within a certain period of time, do they need to be included, or is it only current status?
Right now it's current data, but if there's something potential, something that kind of stands out in your brain that happened within the last year or two?
Yeah, I think you're asking about past.
Yeah.
Some panelists have disclosed former employment, and so I'm guessing it's because they personally thought that could potentially be a conflict of interest. So that's more up to you to decide. Yeah.
That's
transparency,
basically. So.
That's it. Great. Thank you. So then, if you could get your filled out forms back to Emma or Jane or one of us on staff, we'll make sure it gets in the appropriate hands. We have 5 minutes before our picture taking. Are there any comments or thoughts or reflections that you would like to share before we get our picture taken? Rachel? Oh, Lorraine, do you have a question, or is that from... Okay. Rachel, do we know where the picture taking is going to take place? Oh, okay. Should we move in that direction and get organized so we can, I think right after that we move on to lunch, right? I'm sorry, say it again. Oh, yeah, we're going to join the Addressing Disparities advisory panel for the rest of the afternoon to learn about a model of theirs that I think you'll really enjoy. And they came to us actually to learn about the ambassadors and the rubric. So we're gonna do some joint listening and joint thinking. I think it's going to be really interesting. This is the first time any panel has done this. So I'll be interested in your reflections at the end of the day on it. So we'll go take our pictures, we'll go to lunch, and then we will convene in Magnolia C. Correct? I haven't seen the setup, so I would say let's take everything. Any other comments before we break? Oh, Laurel.
Sorry. I have a quick comment or a question about the COI. Is being a member of one of the, like, energy oncology, which is a research group, I should be disclosing that, right? Okay. Thank you.
Steve, you have a question, or is that conscious stuff? Right. For those of you on the phone, we will be taking a break until 1 o'clock Eastern time. And at that time, we will reconvene. Okay, thank you.